Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's February 19th. We are in Parshas Kisetze, page 1046. The bottom of the page, Pasuk Yudches, verse 18. Ki eli ish bein sorer umoreh. When a man will have a son who is wayward. They translate it as? Wayward and rebellious. Okay. Einenu shomea b'kol aviv u'v'kol imoi. Does not listen to his father's voice nor his mother's voice. V'yisruo, so they shall warn him v'lo yishma alehem. And it says they shall discipline him and he does not listen to them. V'sof suvo aviv v'imo. His father and mother shall grab hold of him. And they shall take him out to the elders of his city, and to the gate of his place. They will say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is wayward and rebellious. He does not listen to our voices. He is gluttonous and
a drunkard.
Okay. Uragamuhu kolan she'iro v'avanim v'meis. They will stone him. All the people of the city will stone him and he will die. Uviartara mikirbecha, and you will eradicate the evil from your midst. V'chol yisrael yishmu v'yiro, and all the Jews will listen and be afraid. Now, this is a child who is wayward and rebellious. And he is put to death. So, what did he do for which he should deserve the death penalty? How much could he have done wrong? Did he murder someone? Well, if he murdered someone, he should be put to death for that. Not because he's wayward and rebellious. Did he worship idolatry? Then he should be put to death for that. Not because he's wayward and rebellious. If he's being put to death because he's a sorer umore, he's wayward and rebellious, that means he has not done something else for which the Torah calls for the death penalty. Unless we are to suggest that he did do something for which the Torah calls for the death penalty, but not stoning, that it would have been a more lenient form of execution. Stoning is the most stringent form of execution. So perhaps he did something for which there's a more lenient form of execution, but because he is a wayward and rebellious son, therefore he gets the more severe execution of stoning. One could have suggested that. But that is not that would not be the truth. Chazal tells us he did nothing else for which one would be executed. He did not do any sin in the Torah that calls for execution. Rather, he behaved as a wayward and rebellious son. So we have to define what that means. What does it mean he behaved as a wayward and rebellious son? Does that mean he didn't clean up his room when he was told to? Like, what does that mean that he's a wayward and rebellious son? So the Torah tells us that he is gluttonous and a drunkard. So Chazal tell us that in order for him to be a wayward and rebellious son of Ben Sorer Moreh, he has to steal money from his father, from his parents. He has to steal money, use that money to purchase wine and meat, and he has to consume them. There's a certain amount of wine and meat that he has to consume. He has to consume them in a gluttonous fashion, which means that the meat isn't even fully cooked yet. He's so gluttonous, he's rushing and he just gobbles down the meat as soon as it's partially edible. That is the sign of a wayward and rebellious son. He has no control. He is running after his desires to the point that he steals money and does this gluttonous act. The Gemara tells us he does this at his parents' house. It's not that he does it away, like in secret, but he does it at his parents' house. That's where he does this act of being gluttonous. Even with that, the first time he does that, he would not be executed. As the Torah says, in the end of Pasuk Yudches, verse 18, at the top of page 1048, V'yisruo, so they will discipline him. The first thing that happens is the parents take their son to Beis Din, to the court, and the court gives him lashes. They give him corporal punishment for having stolen money from his father and purchased wine and meat and eaten them in a gluttonous and drunken fashion. Then, if he does it again, then he would be executed. It would take a second time after already having been disciplined for having done it the first time. And he continues to behave in that manner. That would be the ben sorer umoreh. There are several other parameters that limit this case dramatically. The Gemara tells us that in order for a boy, first of all, it's only a boy, not a girl. Second of all, in order for a boy to be liable as a ben sorer umoreh, he must be over bar mitzvah. If he's under bar mitzvah, he cannot be held accountable for his actions. So he has to be over bar mitzvah. But at the same time, the Gemara tells us he can't be too old either. Because if he's too old, then he's just being independent. That doesn't show that he is wayward and rebellious. It may show that he is gluttonous and a drunkard, but that doesn't show that he is wayward and rebellious. So where would we see that he'd be wayward and rebellious? So the Gemara says it has to take place, this act of theft plus eating in a gluttonous and drunken fashion, after he turns bar mitzvah, but before he turns 13 and 3 months. There's only a 3-month window for this to apply. So it's very, very limited for it to apply. But there's even more limitations than that. The Gemara tells us both parents have to want to take him to court. If one, either the father does and not the mother, mother does not the father, he would not be considered a ben sorer umoreh. The Gemara tells us that the parents have to they have to be able to physically grab hold of him. They have to be able to see what he's doing, hear what he's doing. The parents have to warn him. And there are many other limitations mentioned in the Gemara about this case, to the point where it's nearly impossible for it to happen. It is so limited that it's a very, very unusual circumstance indeed that this would actually take place. But the Gemara then tells us a rule that makes it actually impossible. See, even what I've told you so far, it is theoretically possible, even though it's unlikely. But it is possible this would happen. But then the Gemara lists one more criterion which makes it impossible. And that is that the Gemara tells us that he doesn't listen. The Pasuk says he does not listen to the voice of his father and the voice of his mother. And then it says he doesn't listen to our voice. So Chazal tell us that in order for a ben sorer umoreh to actually fall into this category, the parents must have the same voice. Now, from a allegorical standpoint, that would mean they have to be on the same page, both of them warning him. He doesn't get mixed messages from his parents. It's clear to him that they both are saying the same thing. But the Gemara tells us, according to one opinion, literally they have to have the same voice. They must sound the same. Therefore, the Gemara says this case is impossible, because one of the signs that a man is unable to bear children is if his voice is too feminine. And one of the signs that a woman is unable to bear children is if her voice is too masculine. So if the parents' voices are exactly the same, either the father is his voice is too feminine, or the mother, her voice is too masculine, which renders it impossible for at least one of them to bear a child. And therefore, this should not be able to happen. Whether you understand it to mean that it's impossible, or whether you understand it to mean it is very, very unlikely to happen, either way, no one is saying it's likely. Everybody is agreeing that it is a very, very unlikely scenario. Whether it is or isn't, the Gemara tells us, Ben Sorer Umore Lo Haya. It never happened. The Gemara says it never happened. Despite the fact we have this paragraph in the Torah, it never took place. The previous paragraph, the two previous paragraphs, the one we had about capturing a woman while at war and taking her as a wife, that did happen. It was rare, as we explained when we learned it, that the whole way the Torah is setting it up is in order to combat the Yetzer Hara, and it is meant to be a deterrent to the Yetzer Hara, but it did happen. This never happened, Lo Haya. But the Gemara adds a phrase to that. Not only Lo Haya didn't happen, V'lo Asid Lihios, it will never happen.
So why is it written in the
Torah? So the Gemara's next question is, Im Kain Lama Nechtav. So why does the Torah write it?
Mm-hmm.
If it never happened and it never will happen, so why is it here? And the Gemara answers with a cryptic line, Drosh V'kabel Schar. Drosh means expound upon it, V'kabel Schar, and receive reward. That is the line of the Gemara. That phrase, Drosh V'kabel Schar, appears a few places in the Gemara, a few different places. In every place that it appears, it is cryptic. And this is one of the classic examples, this is one of the most famous examples of that phrase, Drosh V'kabel Schar, expound upon it and receive reward. That statement could be taken to mean that even though it never happened and never will happen, it's still part of the Torah. Since it's part of the Torah, therefore, it is included in studying Torah. When you study this paragraph of the Ben Sorer Umora, you are studying Torah. Therefore, when you expound upon it, you will receive reward, no different than studying any other part of the Torah. The fact that it isn't relevant does not render it not Torah. It's still Torah. And therefore, one could study it, should study it, and one receives reward for the study of Torah. So that is certainly true. There's no question about it, that if one studies part of the Torah which is not relevant to that person, it doesn't make a difference. One still is studying Torah. Today, when we study all the laws of the karbanos, the sacrifices, even though we have no Beis HaMikdash, they cannot offer a sacrifice, it doesn't make a difference. We are still receiving reward for studying the Torah. But that can't be the full explanation for that line, Drosh V'kabel Schar, expound upon it and receive reward, because that wouldn't answer the Gemara's question. The Gemara wasn't asking, what should you do with this paragraph once it's here? Once the paragraph is here, then you should study it, because it's Torah. But that wasn't the Gemara's question. The Gemara's question was, if it never happened and never will happen, why was it written down? Why did Hashem command it? Why is it here? So to simply say, expound upon it and receive reward, you can expound upon all other parts of the Torah and receive reward as well. That doesn't justify Hashem adding this to the Torah if it never happened and never will happen. And therefore, the phrase Drosh V'kabel Schar, expound upon it and receive reward, must mean that justifies it being included in the Torah, which means there must be something that we can derive from here that enriches the Torah, that makes the Torah a better Torah for us, the fact that it is here. It must be the case. Yes?
Could it be that because HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what Haya Havev Yiyeh, in the future with all the gullus that have been, the situation actually might come up that will be applicable?
So the Gemara says it never happened and never will happen. That's a pretty strong statement for the Gemara to make. The Gemara is saying it will never happen. So that means that no matter what, in the future it won't happen. Mm-hmm. So it becomes very difficult. So Rashi tells us at the end of Parashas Ha'azinu what the phrase drosh v'kabel schar means. At the end of Ha'azinu, Rashi tells us that we know that the pasuk tells us the pasuk. Just want to see which pasuk Rashi refers to over there. We'll go back and look at the pasuk. I just want to make sure I get the right pasuk. Rashi tells us that it's not the pasuk is not over here. We're going to turn back to Sefer Bereishis. The pasuk says back in Parshas Vayishlach. Back in Parshas Vayishlach, at the end of the parsha, we have the descendants of Esav. And one of the infamous descendants of Esav is, of course, Amalek. If you look on page 192, Paraklamid Vav, chapter 36, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. The Pasuk tells us, Visimna Haisa Pilegesh. Timna was a Pilegesh. She was a concubine. Le'alifaz ben Esav. To Alifaz, the son of Esav. Vatela le'alifaz es Amalek. And she birthed for Alifaz Amalek. So Amalek's parents are Eliphaz and Timnah. That's pretty bad. But who is Timnah? Who is she? So the Torah tells us on the next page, still the same chapter, Pasuk, Chaf Beis, verse 22. It says, Vayu v'nei Lotan, the sons of Lotan were Chori v'Hemam. They were Chori and Hemam. Va'achos Lotan, Timna. Timna was the sister of Lotan. Well, who was Lotan? So if we go back to Psukim, to the beginning of this paragraph, Pasuk Chav, verse 20, Ela v'nei Seir ha-Chori. The following are the sons of Seir. The Chori, that's the nation, Yoshvei ha-Aretz, those who dwelled in the land. They are Lotan, Vishoval, Vitzion, Va'ana, Vitzivon, Va'ana. So, Lotan is the eldest son of Seir. Seir was lived in the land that eventually became Esav's land, and he was the king over that land. He was in charge of that land. And he had a daughter named Timnah. Timnah was the sister of Lotan. Lotan was his son. So this woman, Timnah, was a concubine to Eliphaz, the son of Esav, and from there comes Amalek. Now, why does the Torah tell us this sister of Lotan was Timnah? What is that important for us to know? What does that teach us? We asked before, who is Timnah? the answer doesn't seem to shed much more light on that. I mean, okay, so she was the daughter of this person, Seir, and she married Eliphaz. She was his concubine. So Rashi explains, Lafisha Amraf, because she said, Eini kedai lios lo leisha, Timna wanted to marry Avraham Avinu, and she couldn't. So then she wanted to marry a descendant of Avraham Avinu. So she tried to marry Eliphaz. And Eliphaz wouldn't marry her. So she said, well, if I can't be his wife, halavai ve'eya pilagsho, at least I'll be his concubine. V'chol kach lama, why is that important to know? Because lahudia shvacho shal Avraham, it teaches us the praise of Avraham, shal yu shiltonim umelachim, that kings and leaders misavim lidavek bizarro, desired to join in with his descendants. Timna was the daughter of a king or a leader, someone who was a powerful person, and she so much wanted to join Avraham Avinu's family that she was even willing to be a lowly concubine to Eliphaz. That was worth it to her. And Rashi here says, this teaches us, Lo lechinam atem yegeim ba, excuse me, I'm sorry, the wrong part. Ein lecha davar reikon batorah. There's nothing empty in the Torah. Shem tidreshenu, that if you expound upon it, she'ein bo matan schar, that there is no reward. There's no empty thing in the Torah that if you expound upon it, that you won't receive reward. So Rashi here is explaining that phrase, drosh v'kabel schar, expound upon it and receive reward. That means there's something that can be derived from what is it says in the Torah, which is enriching, which helps us understand better. That is what Rashi tells us. But he doesn't explain this case, our case of the Ben Sorer Umore, what it is that we are gaining from here. So, it seems to me this is something which, I've been saying for many years. It seems to me that the point the Torah is making is the following. Why is the Ben Sorer Umore killed? So, he was a glutton, he's a drunkard, he's a thief, and he's a young guy, and he's rebellious and he's wayward. Okay? But he didn't do anything for which he deserves to be put to death. He didn't kill anybody. He didn't do anything, any capital crime. So the Gemara tells us the reason why the Ben Sorer Umore is put to death is al shame sofo, because of his end. That the Torah is saying, if you don't put this young man to death now, what is going to happen in the future is he is going to grow up and he will need money to feed his taivos, to feed his desires. He will not be able to find enough money to fuel what he wants to do. His work ethic will be poor, and therefore he will not have the kind of money that he needs to fuel the lifestyle that he is trying to have. And therefore he will resort to a life of crime in which he is malastem es habrios, that he will be a thief stealing from people, which a person who lives his life like that will eventually take somebody's life. They will eventually commit murder, because that's what's going to happen. There's going to be some kind of, he's going to get caught, he's going to get into a fight, whatever it is, and he's going to commit murder. So the Torah says, you should put him to death now, and that is the merciful thing to do, because yamus zakai, Ve'al Yamos Chayev. Let him die when he is still meritorious. Don't let him die after he has lost all of his merit and he's now liable. Kill him now, not later. Now, we can't make such a calculation. How could we decide such a thing? Who knows what's going to be with the child? You have no idea. How can you say, kill him now rather than later? It's one thing if a person actually committed a crime for which they deserve capital punishment. The Torah says to kill the person. Okay, so we listen to the Torah, we put the person to death. It doesn't matter what's going to happen in the future. If a person commits murder or worships idolatry or violates Shabbos with warning, with witnesses, the Torah says put him to death. The fact that this person is prepared to do teshuvah and is going to sincerely never do it again, that cannot be taken into account in a court of law. A court of law can't deal with that. Hashem can deal with that, but we can't deal with that. There have to be rules that are followed. And a court of law has to be, have that system where if the protocol was followed and the person deserves to be put to death, they have to be put to death. Doesn't make a difference. The fact that the person wants to do tshuva, the fact that the person has a family that he's leaving behind, we can't take those things into account because we have to have rules, we have to have laws. Hashem takes those things into account. So that is the way that a court of law works. But we can't make a calculation, kill a person who has not done anything for which they should deserve capital punishment, kill them now in order to prevent them from being worse later. How could we, we're only human beings, we have no idea how this person's going to behave, we don't know, we all know of cases where a person looked like they were headed down the wrong path and then they turned themselves around and they did better and they didn't end up in a very bad place. They got better than they were. Maybe that's not the rule, but it does happen once in a while. So how do we make a calculation to kill the person now to prevent them from getting worse? The answer is we don't make that calculation. Hashem makes that calculation. Hashem tells us this child needs to be put to death now because I'm telling you that if you don't, he will end up committing murder. Says Hashem. This child will end up committing a capital crime. There is no doubt about it. This is not something which you are leaving up to your guesswork. This is not an educated guess. This is Hashem talking. Hashem says, a boy who behaves in this manner at this age with all of these parameters that I've put into this paragraph, if the boy meets all of those parameters and does the crime precisely the way it's described in the Torah, says Hashem, I know. There's nothing left to doubt anymore. This boy will end up committing a capital crime. Therefore, I am telling you, I am being merciful on this boy. Kill him now. Don't wait. Because if you wait, he's going to become liable before you kill him. Kill him now when he still will go to Gan Eden, to Olam Haba, because whatever he's done isn't so terrible. And therefore he will be okay. So I am telling you, says Hashem, that the merciful thing to do is to kill him now, and I am commanding you to kill him now, says Hashem, because that is the merciful thing to do. We're asking parents to take their own child to Beis Din to be executed. Says Hashem to the parents, I know parents have an incredible level of mercy for their child. Hashem says to the parent, this is being merciful. Take him to court, have them try that child, and if they find him guilty, have them put him to death now. Don't wait. That is Hashem talking. Says the Gemara, the parameters are so limited, and so limiting, I should say, that the Ben Sora Umora never happened. And not only that, it never will happen. It seems to me, drosh v'kabel schar, expound upon this and receive reward. You see a child under bar mitzvah, over bar mitzvah, a teenager, behaving in a very, very terrible way. And that child is behaving in a gluttonous way, a drunken way. That child seems to be out of control. That child is thieving. That child is lying. That child is cheating. And you say to yourself, there's no hope for this child. There's no way this child will ever turn out to be a productive member of society. There's no way this child will ever become a tzaddik. this child will never make it to Olam Haba. Says the Torah, you're guessing. You don't know. Because says the Torah, I already told you the case where you know this child's not going to make it. That's the Ben Sora Remora. That's where you know the child's not going to make it. The child you're seeing is not exactly this case, because this case never happened and never will. Therefore, what you're seeing may be a child that is on a bad path. You may be seeing a child that is, it's going to be a rough road, but you cannot predict with certainty that whatever you're seeing, that that child is not going to make it. Because the one that's not going to make it is the Ben Sora Amora. And that never happened. And that never will. Which means every child has a chance. Don't give up on any child. Don't give up on any teenager. Don't give up on anybody. Because there still is hope. Because I told you the case of no hope. That's this case. And it never happened. And it never will. The Torah writes the case of the hopeless child, the one that there is no hope for. You should put him to death now rather than later. The Torah writes it, but it never happened, never will happen. Why did the Torah write it? Precisely for that reason, to tell you there's no such thing as a hopeless child. There is such a thing, but it never happened, and it never will. And therefore, practically, there's no such thing. It seems to me that's the drosh, the Kabbal Skar. Expound upon it, and you will receive reward. You can bring out of what we read over here a powerful lesson in not giving up on anybody, not giving up on any child, not giving up on any teenager, just because we see that they're in a very bad place. They may very well be in a very bad place, and it may be a very difficult road for them to get into a good place. That certainly can be true, and we've seen it over and over again, but it's not hopeless. And that is the point I believe the Torah is making here with Drosh, the Kabbal Skar. Expound upon it and receive reward. The parasha ends off, this paragraph ends off, with that they stone him, this person that never happened and never will, but theoretically, they would stone him, he'd be put to death, you'll eradicate the evil from your midst, and it ends off at the end of Pasuk Chavah, verse 21, V'chol Yisrael yishmu v'yiro, all Jews will hear and be afraid. This teaches us that in the event that this would happen, this would require hachraza. This would require that it be publicized, announced. Even though we wouldn't normally publicize a sin, we wouldn't normally publicize an execution in this way. It's not the kind of thing that you want people to know about. Obviously, there are people who are there who will know. But the fact that it says all the Jews will hear and be afraid, that means that we make this public. We put it out on all of the news outlets. We want everybody to know what happened, that this young man was executed as a Ben Sorer Umoreh. That is an important thing. Why is that an important thing? Because if this should happen, then the Jews have to know that this child was put to death. It's a very difficult thing to put this child to death. The parents, for them to take their child and have him put to death. The court, to take such a young person and put him to death. For something which is in the future, which hasn't happened yet. Which is, it's not punishment for what he's going to do, it's to prevent him from what he's going to do, to save him from himself. That's a very difficult decision to make. Therefore, it needs to be publicized. People have to know that it was done, that the Beis Din did it, and that they followed the rules of the Torah. And everybody needs to make sure to follow the rules of the Torah, and to even though it may be a very, very difficult thing to do. But as I said, it actually never happened and never will happen. Yeah.
Is that because we had the village in Tshuva? So with that alone, it would never happen.
That the Gemara is not saying that. The Gemara is not saying the reason why it never happened is because of the ability to do Tshuva. The Gemara is saying it never happened because the parameters here that the parents would warn him and he would steal and buy that amount of meat and wine and eat it raw or mostly raw and drink the wine in a gluttonous, and then get lashes and then do it again. And all this within the span of 13 years old to 13 and 3 months, it just never happened and never will. Just, it's not that, not because of tshuva, it's because the parameters are so limited or limiting. And that's the thing. The Torah is saying this is the only way that if it would happen, then the merciful thing to do would be to put this person to death. But that, again, it's not something practical because it never happened. Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22, on page 1048. Next paragraph. V'chiyev ish chet mishpat maves v'humas, and it will be when a man has a sin for which it is a capital crime and he has been put to death, v'saliso so al eitz, then we are required to hang him on a tree. This is not a form of execution. This is not executing by hanging. This is after a person is stoned and put to death through stoning, and the person's already dead, there's a requirement to hang them from a tree. Now, when we conjure up the image of a dead person hanging from a tree, we conjure up the image of a lynching. We conjure up a picture of a person with a noose around their neck hanging from a tree. But that is not what the Torah is referring to over here. There's no noose around his neck. The person is already dead. And the way it is done is his hands are tied together and the hands are put over the limb of a tree. The hands are tied together. So now and then the person is suspended from the limb of a tree. That is a requirement. Meaning people should see what happened to this person. This person was stoned. But then the Torah says, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23, Lo salin nivla so'al ha'etz, do not allow his body to be overnight on the tree. Ki kavor tikberenu bayom hahu, you shall bury him on that same day. Ki kilalas elokim taloi. Now that's a difficult phrase to translate it. They translate it as, for a hanging person is a curse of God. It is a form of a curse of God to have a hanging person. Velositameas ad mascha, do not defile your land. Asher Hashem Elokecha nosen lecha nachala, that Hashem your God has given you as an inheritance. So there is a requirement to hang the person by a tree. The phrase, again, it conjures up an incorrect image. I would rather say suspend a person from a tree after they've been stoned. That's a requirement. And the person is then, but when we do that, we are not permitted to leave the person up on the tree more than, we're not permitted to leave him up overnight. You have to take him down, it is a curse of God to leave him up there. Now, if it's a curse of God to leave him up there, why do we put him up there in the first place? I mean, it's a curse of God, it's a curse of God. Whatever that means that it is, then why does it make a difference if it's overnight? It should be, whatever the problem is as being a curse of God, that should be true right away as well. Now, practically, what did they do when they had to stone someone? They would kill the person. Stoning is really, the execution of stoning is actually death by falling. That's really what it is. Stoning is the impact of a stone against the person. That's what kills him. Impact can be done by throwing a stone at a person or by throwing the person into a stone. Either way, it's the same thing. It's the impact that kills him. So the way it was done, I know it's not fun to talk about these things graphically, but just to be aware of how it worked, is the person was pushed off of a two-story drop onto stone. Landing on stone, it would kill the person instantly when they hit the ground. It's not the ground, they hit stone from a two-story high building. The reason why it was two stories up is because it needed to kill him, So it couldn't be too low, but the Torah does not want him mutilated from the fall. A very high fall would mutilate the body. The goal is not to mutilate the body, just to kill the person. And that is the way it was done. In the event that the person did not die from the fall, then a stone was thrown on him, but that was an unusual thing. Generally, the fall would kill him. If they had to stone someone, and stoning did happen rarely, but it did happen through the years when we had autonomy in Israel and were able to try capital crimes during the first temple era. So it did happen, although it was rare. When it happened, then the next thing they did is they took the person, tied his hands together, and put him up on top of a tree, meaning they suspended him from the branch of a tree. They left him there for a couple of minutes and immediately took him down and buried him. Because the Torah says, don't leave him up there overnight. And if you leave him there a little too long, maybe you'll forget. So they would immediately take the body down. They would just fulfill the mitzvah. Hang him up, take him down. It was a quick thing. They wouldn't leave him up there for any extended period of time. They would immediately take him down and they would bury him. But they needed to fulfill the mitzvah of suspending him from the tree. So they did do it, and then they would, bury him. What does it mean that it is the curse of God? How do they translate it here? It is a hanging person is a curse of God. Ki kilalas Elokim taloi. It is the curse of God to have someone hanging there. So Chazal tell us, because each and every one of us were created B'Tselem Elokim in the image of God, and to publicly display someone who unfortunately committed a sin that was so bad that he had to be stoned, and to display that publicly, it is a form of a degrading of, not an actual degrading, but it is a, we'll call it not a degrading, we'll call it a disrespect for the name of God himself.
It's called an affront to God.
An affront to God, okay. So it's an affront to Hashem, to have a Tzelem Elokim, someone who is created in the image of Hashem, to be hanging there. But then that begs the question. So then why does the Torah say to put him up there? So the answer is, because here we have a catch-22. On the one hand, it's an affront to God to have him hanging there. On the other hand, it is important that people see what happened so that they will not do the same thing. We do need to demonstrate what happens if, God forbid, a person commits a sin this bad. So it's a kind of like a bind. So the Torah says, hang him up, but then take him down. Don't leave him up there. So we put him up so that there should be at least enough of a display to frighten people, but then take him down immediately. But then you have to ask the question, if you take him down immediately, how many people are you going to frighten exactly? How many people are there when you put him up on the tree? The ones who were there for the execution, they already saw the execution. They don't need to see him hung up on a tree. The ones who missed the execution, and they show up now, how many more people are going to see him up on the tree? So this brings up a very, very important point in human psychology and capital punishment that my Rosh Yeshiva Rav Weinberg Zechon Racha used to say, which is the following. People think that capital punishment is a deterrent for terrible crimes because no one wants to get killed. So if we say that this crime, the punishment for it will be execution, people don't want to get executed, so they don't do the crime. But the truth is that that doesn't stop too many people. If a person is at a point where they're prepared to commit a really terrible crime, the fear of execution is very unlikely to stop the person. It may cause them to do it in a more secretive way, or in a way where they can get away, run away afterwards. But if they're prepared to do a crime this bad, there's a lot going on that's already gotten them to this point. A person who's prepared to murder, for example, they didn't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to commit a murder. They got to a point where they're ready to murder. At that point, whether it's out of anger or passion or whatever it is, the fear of being executed themselves is unlikely to stop them. And that's true for any sin where there's capital punishment. So what is, in fact, the point of capital punishment? So the Rosh Hashiva used to say, the point of capital punishment is to project to society that we do not tolerate this kind of behavior. This kind of behavior puts a person outside the pale of society. Society looks at this behavior as despicable, disgusting, absolutely immoral, and wrong. That's what capital punishment does. It sends a very powerful message to people. This behavior is totally and completely unacceptable. And people don't like to behave in a way that is perceived by society as unacceptable. Even criminals don't like to do that. People don't like to be that way. Criminals also have self-respect. Very often, a criminal who is committing a crime, very often they have supporters for what they're doing, who are championing what he's doing, whatever it is that he's doing wrong. To act completely outside the bounds of society with no one championing what the person is doing, that's a very rare thing. And capital punishment sends that message more strongly than anything else. This form of behavior is unacceptable. And therefore, we need to hang the person up, suspend the person from the tree, not so that people will see him suspended from the tree, although some people will, but so that people know that he was suspended from a tree. Not only was he stoned, he was then put up on a tree for all to see. That knowledge that that's what was done to this person, which is a degrading way to treat a person, to kill them and then to put them up for display, that's a degrading thing. That sends the message that this behavior is unacceptable. And that allows the punishment to be a deterrent. Part of the problem with the current state of capital punishment is that it fails to be a deterrent because it is done in a way, first of all, that the punishment doesn't happen for years after the crime. By the time the punishment happens, nobody remembers the crime anymore. Mm-hmm. And if anything, people will feel bad for the criminal because, I mean, it was so long ago and nobody remembers the victim anymore. Those emotions, except for perhaps the immediate family, those emotions are no longer strong in people by the time they finally put the person to death. A. B, it's not done publicly. Now, I wouldn't want to watch an execution any more than anybody else would want to watch an execution. But a public execution is something that sends a message, something which is done quietly and in a way that nobody ever knows about it, that does not send the message very strongly. And finally, it is done in a way that is so cleaned up that it almost seems, I'm not advocating there should be more pain or suffering, but the fact of the matter is that it's done in a way where it almost seems like, well, you know, the person was already, you know, they committed the crime when they were, you know, 30 years old, and now they're 65 years old, and, you know, they've lived a whole life already, and then, you know, basically they went to sleep and never woke up. So are we executing the person? Yes, but we're not taking advantage of execution in a way that would deter whatever crime was done decades ago by the time we put this person to death. What the Torah is saying is, first of all, we don't wait around. When we try a capital crime and the person is found guilty, he is executed on the same day. We do not wait. That's called inui hadin. To make a person wait till the next day to be executed is considered cruel. And we put him to death immediately. He shouldn't wait around thinking about what's going to happen. And then, after the execution, If it's a stoning, then we suspend the person from the tree, take him down and bury him. But we do that act which is degrading, and it is an affront to God. It's degrading, so to speak, for God himself. But it's worthwhile in order to prevent any further behavior like this. The Rosh Yeshiva used to say a fascinating thing, and we'll end with this point the Rosh Yeshiva used to say. This was back in the days when hijacking a plane was a way that people made demands. We're not talking about suicide hijackers, which was a new thing with 9/11. But before that time, hijacking was done in order to get demands. You know, we want this, we want that, whether it's to let some prisoners go, whether it was for money, whatever. It was a form of coercing governments or entities to do what you wanted them to do. So, how did hijacking work? They would these criminals would hijack a plane, and then they would force the plane to land wherever it was going to land, and then they would have certain demands, and they always threatened if the demands were not met, they would kill everybody on the plane, or they would blow up the plane, or whatever it is. So you've got this whole, you know, they've got a whole, you know, hundreds of passengers on the plane, innocent people, and you've got these terrible animals who are holding them hostage. So the Rosh Yeshiva used to say that the way they dealt with hijacking was with negotiating. That's what they would do. So the Rosh Yeshiva said, like, that means that the whole process of hijacking became a business. It's a way of doing business. Really, it's any hostage taking is a way of doing business. Sometimes the business deal works out and the hostages go free and they're fine. Sometimes they don't and they're killed. The Rosh Yeshiva used to say, this was his words, if the first time anybody ever hijacked a plane, they would have said to him, we're not doing business with you. You want to kill the passengers? Go ahead and kill the passengers. But you're not coming out of this alive. You're going to get killed no matter what. We're not letting you go. You want to kill them? You can kill them, but we're killing you. Go ahead, but you're not getting anything from us. If that would have been the attitude, and they would have taken the hijacker, and his words were, and they would have hung him from the highest tree, he said, there may have been a second hijacking, but there never would have been a third. That would have been it. The whole business would have ended right there. And he said, because we couldn't do that, because the innocent people on the plane, who we had to save, and we're not making light of that. That's a real thing. But because of that, he said, thousands upon thousands of future passengers were doomed to die because the first hijackers were not dealt with in that way. But those were his words. If you would have hung him from the highest tree, let everybody see this is what happens, then it doesn't happen anymore. It's not the death, it's the statement that this behavior is absolutely unacceptable. That's what stops crime. And the Torah here is even willing to, Hashem is willing to have, so to speak, a diminishing of his honor in people's eyes. That's worth it in order to send this message. But then you cut him down right away and you bury him. That's the way it's done.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.